Chapter 20. Heavy Front Coming. Sean caught the tail end of a few moments of darkness, which were trashed by a bright white light that flooded and sputtered quite rudely over everything. It exposed a lunatic landscape. White regolith pocked with deep black craters, drawing in everything about them as the flare descended. In one such hole, Sean was lying in mud-splattered snow, while something insistently heavy was pushing down on his head. He shifted to sit up. A harsh whisper bellowed at him.
"Stay down, you fool. You want to lose your thinker?"
As if in illustration, a passing whiz informed him that there was indeed danger to be had. He threw himself back down in the mud and tried to latch on orally to his latest savior. The heavy thing weighing down his head was a helmet. On digital examination, it had a single large spike on top, and this probably wasn't for keeping receipts on. He and the human forms around him were wearing military greatcoats, and each had a rifle. And all around them were festive decorations celebrating war. Barbed wire, shell holes, bodies, and, on closer inspection, bits thereof. The flare was still coming down dangerously slowly, and a murderous fire was progressively reducing the reconnaissance party he was in to just him and an officer. The officer was filling some figures into a small notebook. He finished a column, snapped an elastic band around both it and the pencil, and said,
"Right, that's enough field theory for one night. Back to the trench, men. Man."
Sean copied the man's manner of movement, slithering like an apprentice eel through the slush and earthy goo, from blast crater to crater. All around them, bullets were popping into the snow and mud, and the occasional rat-a-tat-tat of machine guns broke any ascendant complacency, if any had been attempted. Then one last good long slither brought them into the welcome depth of a trench, and wading through icy water that came up over the knees.
"Come to my office," said the man he had followed.
"Office? Here?"
"Well, I am an officer. What's the difference between other ranks and an officer?" "An office, of course. Got to keep up appearances. Foreign visitors might drop in on us any moment. Aggressive takeovers are likely, they say."
His office was a digression of the trench, upmarket by virtue of a jumbled covering of timber throwovers, and an ensuite latrine and, no jokes aside, running water. It was freezing, and Sean was wet everywhere imaginable. He stood there shivering while the man lit a lantern, which only served to give the shadows a sense of victory. When the officer took his helmet off, Sean could see he was balding, and he was attempting to compensate for it by an enormous bushy moustache. Otherwise, he was a gentle-looking, soft-spoken man in his early 40s. The only thing aggressive about him were his penetrating, intelligent eyes. The officer took out his notebook again and made ready to take notes by holding his writing hand against the tiny lantern, trying to get some life into his frozen fingers.
"So, tell me, what is your name?"
"Sean, sir,"
stuttered Sean through jittering teeth. He'd never regretted his name before.
"Sean Saint-Pierre."
Now the officer gave him a second reason to regret his name.
"Jean Saint-Pierre? That's a foreign name. French, isn't it? If it's not a personal question, aren't you the enemy?"
No, I'm not."
"Sure?"
"Yes, sir, sure. I seem to remember there is a procedure for this. I have a feeling I'm supposed to have you shot or dock your wages or something." "I'm not the enemy. I'm Swiss. I'm neutral."
"Then what are you doing here, in a German uniform, holding a rifle?"
Delivering chocolate?"
suggested Sean lamely, then quickly threw out a backup invention.
"I mean, observing?
Or spying?"
"What is the difference?" asked Sean.
"A firing squad."
Before Sean could panic fully, the officer brightened.
"Oh, all right then. Sometimes you have to take a person's word for it. Put me down for nuts and raisins. My name is Karl Schwarzschild, by the way, artillery. They shook hands. Actually, my real job is astrophysicist. Artillery officer is just a temping job between pieces. Karl Schwarzschild picked up his pencil and wrote, Debrief report, 0720 hours, about January 1916, in his battered, stained, and hip-bone-bowed notebook. What did you see? He asked. What? Surprised Schoenbach. Out there, just now? Yes. Snow, mud. Yes, but anything unusual? Flares, dead bodies? Yes, yes, yes. Anything unusual? Well, no. God fadori, swore the man, and put down his notebook to rub his exhausted eyes. We'll have to go out again tomorrow night. But, sir, what is it you're looking for? Asked Sean. Data, proof, to verify Einstein's field theory. Sorry, what did you say? I am trying to solve Einstein's general relativity field equations. Out there? Gasped Sean. Well, where else? It's a lot safer in here. Yes, but this is a deep, dark hole. Here I can verify deep, dark hole theory. But I obviously need to be out there in the field to test field theory. You're completely balmy, aren't you? Said Sean. I certainly hope so. Being sane out here would be, well, mad, wouldn't it, Corporal? Totally inconsistent, sir, said the corporal, who had come in on his regular louse collection round for the morning's cappuccinos. Excuse me, sir, but what is this field theory you're trying to prove? Out here we know all about the field, replied the artillery officer. The equation goes like this. Take a knight, any knight, then add one soldier, enclosed by barbed wire brackets, over an open field, multiply by a factor of a lit cigarette, and this all equals one dead duck. What is that supposed to mean? Now, this is the interesting bit. Lieutenant Schwarzschild pulled out a sheaf of papers, on which were scribbled thousands of mathematical calculations. See? He eventually found and pointed out one set of equations, which, judging by the mud, water-stained, and erratic scrawl, had surely been written while face down in a bomb crater by the light of passing flares. The sum of dead ducks is expressed by the equation let n be the number of numbskulls in a given field at time zero, and x be the number of shells per minute exploding in same field. The rate of increase in dead ducks per unit time increases by the inverse square of n, follow me. An inverse square? That's what Isaac Newton, was trying to work out a rule for, except he said he couldn't for the life of him think what an inverted square might look like. Well, I have found an application for it here, said the Prussian officer proudly. While on leave in Switzerland, I bought a Bernoulli pirated copy of Newton's calculus. Although unlicensed, I managed to crack it and use it to stretch classical maths to the limit. And did it work? Not really. It only approximated the dead duck count well at large numbers. As you can imagine, the classical prediction curve assures us that, at a certain point, there are fewer than one left to kill, and the exponentiality of the equation specifies that to fulfill the conditions of perfect symmetry, this last soldier is neither fully dead nor fully alive when in non-vectored flight from the epicenter, weighted, of course, by the parameters of leg length and hearing acuteness. Plotting this effect, using a broad sample range, I have discovered that death is quantized, whole numbers. You don't have fractions of dead, only fractions of bodies. I see, lied Sean, but thinking of Schrödy the cat of indeterminate living status. It doesn't make any sense in a classical sense, went on Karl Schwarzschild, but it reassures the men. Infinite extrapolation using Laplace's probability functions provides just enough uncertainty to keep the supply of volunteers flowing to ensure we maintain a constant increase in dead ducks. In the end, it is all relative. With Sean's brain thus joining the rest of his body and being totally numbed, they left the dugout office to make a morning's inspection. The sun was just coming up, but most of the soldiers in the trench seemed to be wondering why it bothered at all anymore. In the growing light, Sean began the unrewarding task of assembling a workable hypothesis to explain this brash new world he had woken in. Sorry, sir, Sean asked of the officer's back. This may sound strange to you, but I have no idea where and when I am or why I am here. The artillery lieutenant turned and gave him a look which said eloquently, And this would be strange because... As the dawn dawdled in,
Karl Schwarzschild began to confide in Sean. Long nights gazing through telescopes had given the astronomer a slight permanent squint in one eye that gave you the impression he was wearing a monocle. My teachers were furious when I chose astronomy. They wanted me to do something useful with my life, like drop artillery shells on people. If nothing else, it gives me a sense of direction. Maybe they are right. I've spent too long thinking about reality. Maybe it is time I return to the human world, where everything is preconceived. That's the way forward, they say. He looked through a periscope towards the enemy lines, then handed it to Sean. And look where that got us. Through the homemade box of mirrors, Sean could see that the Russians were hanging out their washing on the barbed wire in brazen breach of the Siegfried Line copyright. That's what the field theory is all about, enthused Karl, patting the package of papers in his inside pocket. Trying to find the point where it all collapses, he continued down the line, head bowed habitually from the weight of his helmet. What collapses? Asked Sean, glancing at the mayhem on the day's agenda. There was a distinct glint in Karl's eye when he turned to say, everything. Ah, good old life, the universe, and sundry phenomena. Sean quoted Newton as he struggled through the trench soup to keep up with the suddenly agile officer as he march-waded along the line for the morning's inspection. A sergeant was doing a roll call.
These are the veterans, said Karl proudly. They've been here nearly a month, and here we have the new recruits, announced Schwarzschild. Gentlemen, welcome to the Great War. What's so great about it? Asked one of the men. I heard it was the first Great War, said a very young man. No, corrected the sergeant. This is the last Great War, the war to end all dispute about whose war is the greatest. What do you think, Private Saulpierre? Asked Karl.
I think you'll find it is just the latest Great War. They all went silent. Many happy returns, said Sean. As they moved further along the line, Karl inquired of Sean,
But haven't you heard? Apparently this is it. This is the war that will end all wars.
This is my third of those. Anything else that makes it great?
Oh, lots of things. Fresh air, poetry, songs, camaraderie, peace and quiet.
Peace and quiet? At least that is what they told me when I joined up. Here, he pointed out a heavily graffitied and shrapnel-decorated enlistment poster entitled, All's Quiet on the Eastern Front.
I think they advertised the Western Front under that slogan, said Sean.
It's syndicated. I was there too, just as noisy. That's why I decided to get away from it all. Holiday on the other front, west to east. Lots of us have done it.
They had worked their way back a distance from the front line, and now were in an artillery compound, where a bunch of artillery pieces were being cleaned and readied for an honest day's work. What we need here is more shell and less shock, said Karl.
It's relative, said a lonely gunner with a chronic digestive tract digression.
Ah, relative, went on Karl. I love that word. It means everything might be possible or equally impossible under certain conditions, provided specific elements, like an observer, are present. That is why I've invited you along, Sean, as a professional observer.
They entered the observation post. Karl gave Sean a pair of binoculars and indicated the enemy lines just 200 meters distant from their own front lines.
The front lines of two great powers are now so close together, they are inside what I call the Schwarzschild radius. You see, within the event horizon, everything is inverted. At a certain distance, the real enemy shifts from being in front of us to being behind us. He jerked his thumb over his shoulder. We have more in common with those poor Russian peasants we are bombarding than the idiot politicians who goaded us here in the first place. This war is an implosion of mankind. The trenches mark out the event horizon, the point where everything inverts. I have described the effect in my mathematical treatise.
He took out his package briefly and patted it in such a way that Sean had the impression it must contain his soul. An orderly arrived and handed Karl a clipboard, on which he filled in and signed the chit for the morning's bombardment.
How would you like it this morning, sir? Inquired the orderly deferentially. I think today short back and sides, replied Karl, and wrote as much in the target coordinate square.
Soon the howitzers were in action. Between explosions, Sean and Karl had a strange conversation.
And then I asked myself, roared Karl, his fingers in his ears, is it a single event horizon or a series of horizontal events? After throwing myself flat on my face every 10 seconds for over a year, I have developed a horizontal event theory. It always ends with a big bang. And starts with just as big a bang, cried Sean, commensurately inspired.
That's good, that's very good.
Sir, what is a genius like you doing in a place like this?
Shouted Sean back through the booms of the guns.
Riemann's space.
Sorry?
I confused it with Niemann's land, no man's land, on the enlistment preferences form when I joined up.
Hey?
Screamed Sean, his own head pounding, as he followed the officer out of the observation post.
What's a Riemann space? And what has it got to do with this place?
Non-Euclidean geometry, of course. That's a geometry you get when you try to draw straight lines with your paper wrapped around a cannon barrel. He squinted towards the sun, trying tokenly to claw its way through the winter haze and wafts of cordite smoke.
For example, if you squished up the sun like a snowball, he grabbed two handfuls of snow to illustrate, and had really, and I do mean really, big hands, you could compact its usual radius of 700,000 kilometers to just 3 kilometers across, but no smaller.
His snowball was crushed to the hardest ice ball possible.
What for?
Puzzled Sean, confirming the conjecture with his own snowball. It wouldn't be much use as a sun if it were only the size of the distance to the nearest newspaper kiosk.
Exactly my point. That's exactly it. At that size, it wouldn't emit enough light to read the newspaper by, anyway, you see? Because it would be so dense and heavy, even light, the fastest thing in the universe would not have enough oomph to get away.
Ah, I understand. You're describing the exact point where the sun would become a black hole, shouted Sean, remembering with agonizing nostalgia such a conversation while drinking hot chocolate in the Grand Café in Lugano, with Pierre-Simon de Laplace, the revolutionary aristocrat between titles.
I know it as the Blob of Dark, said screamed Carl. Dumb name, I agree. I like Black Hole. Catchy. But if I'm not wrong, Calcutta has a prior claim to the Black Hole trademark. They've already got one, you see.
Ah, said Sean for the nth to a major power time that morning. And instead of giving it out, this miniature sun would draw light and everything else within reach for that matter. Back into it.
Carl rubbed mud onto his ice ball till it was completely dark.
That special point, where reality is inverted, is the Schwarzschild radius.
He calipered the ball's width with his index and small finger in illustration.
I see, said Sean. The point of all return. Tell me, sir, if the Earth were all squished up to the size of a Schwarzschild radius, how big would it be?
About 9 millimeters across, the size of my little fingernail.
He stared at a hand with his monocle-like squint. If I still had one, that is.
That's incredible.
Yes. We are talking theoretically, you understand. I mean, where would you put it?
Mind you, when I was on the Western Front, there was this corporal in charge of repapering the dugouts, and he said he would be very interested because he wouldn't mind having a 9 millimeter world to put in his pocket. He liked the caliber.
Is that his ambition, to have the world in his pocket?
That's what he said. Today, Trench 34B, tomorrow, Zavald.
Ah, said Sean yet again, as something occurred to him. This corporal, was he short and did he have a funny moustache?
Carl stopped and wiggled his enormous schnauzer. You find moustaches funny?
No, I just wanted to know if this corporal was a certain megalomaniac I know by the name of Cespuglio.
Are you seriously asking me if there's a megalomaniac out there? Just one?
So what happened then?
I asked him for a quote for redecorating my dugout. He took one look at me, my name, and the fact that I refused to attack on the Sabbath, and he said he'd give me a final answer soon. Now there is a candidate for your Cespuglio. Did a lousy job in the dugout, too.
Bad, was it?
No, just lousy. I'm still itchy now. Got any ointment?
Sorry.
Sean patted his pockets and grey sludge oozed out.
That's when I decided to swap sides.
Betray your country?
No, that would involve getting a whole new wardrobe of clothes, and I hate shopping. I mean just swap sides, west to east, France to Russia. You see, I prefer sunrises to sunsets anyway, and the night sky out here is not ruined by so many flares as on the Western Front.
Bloody advertising!
always reminding us the enemy are there, as if we had forgotten. For stargazing, I take all the night shifts. It makes me very popular with the men. Trouble is, my reading light attracts a lot of interest from the clients.
Clients?
Those who have engaged the German army. Sean looked at his ice ball, and something occurred to him.
Tell me, sir, what happens if you get carried away and do squash the snowball smaller than the Schwarzschild radius?
Ah, there something really weird happens. Space gets too small for its boots and starts to behave like time, and time in retaliation starts to behave like space. A bit petty, I agree, but they have that sort of relationship.
Aha!
Sean would have snapped his fingers if he had been confident they wouldn't have snapped right off, so numb they were.
Do you think it is possible the space inside would become like a capsule, a vehicle to access all time simultaneously?
He thought of the shrouds, ever-present and unseeing inside the haunted house. Anyone in it would experience space-time moving while time stands still.
If you want to know how the Vitruvian crystal works,
Carl smiled at Sean's surprise, there is someone infinitely more able to answer your questions.
Who?
All in good time. After a while, Sean burst out with,
But I don't understand.
The Vitruvian crystal is not massive like the sun. It can't distort all space and time.
Stop thinking like a cow.
Don't you mean like a sheep? Replied Sean, too confused to be properly offended.
No, a cow. Remember Leonardo and Luca Pacioli's cow? How it can't look up, so exists only in two dimensions, oblivious of the observers staring down on it from the upper floor, the third dimension?
In the same way, you have to be in a fourth dimension to view the first three dimensions, and, of course, in a fifth dimension to view the fourth dimension for what it truly is.
Is that what the VC is, a cattle yard viewing platform?
Well, as I understand it, the Vitruvian crystal doesn't exist at any specific moment, but specific moments do exist just outside it.
One of your event horizons? Asked Sean, almosting it with matching facials.
More strictly, a non-event horizon. At its core, there is what I call a singularity. In other words, it acts as though it had a whole of its mass, all of the matter it is composed of, throughout all time, accumulated into its volume momentaneously. Every formulation and reformulation of every atom at any moment, past and future, superimposed. It is, in fact, the most massive object ever in this region of the cosmos, at any rate.
Massive enough to punch a hole in the spend mat?
More like down to the spend mat. Not literally down. Down in the sense of losing our elevation with regards to the origin of the timeline. A bit like a solar flare shorting out and crashing suddenly onto the sun's surface.
So, nodded Sean, could the VC be causing a timeline short out?
Timeline short out. Good metaphor. Nice and nibbly as sound bites go. Where did you get that?
Oh, it's just a bit of nano-technology.
They'd finally moved away from the guns, along another series of trenches and tunnels, to continue the inspection.
Anything to report, Sergeant?
Asked Carl, wading stoically into the mud and sarcasm.
The artillery battery needs recharging, sir.
As he made some calculations for his men, Carl said to Sean,
You know, what the army really doesn't like about equations is that they are the same for both sides.
And what do you use these equations for? Asked Sean.
I calculate the flight of artillery shells.
But they don't fly, sir, interjected the sergeant, taking the list of elevations and charges.
They goes up, and they comes down. Niemann's Land is curved space, sir, and we knows where they lands, on the enemy.
Oh, yes, sergeant, but can you prove it is the enemy?
That is merely a transient state, incoherent when you actually take a look, make an observation. We never see the live ones, and when they are dead, they are not the enemy anymore, just a pile of decomposite matter, neutral at worst. So are we, for that matter.
Well, I'd say it was an example of field effect transformation, sir.
So, replied Carl with infinite patience, you're saying to get the field equation to balance, everybody has to be dead.
Well, I gather, sir, that is the general gist of the peace plan.
Yes, sir, contributed a corporal. They complain afterwards with their own shells, and then when we goes over the top, we observe the body bits and mix a few of ours in with them. If the numbers balance out, we has a field equation. Seems fair to me, sir.
A few of the men nodded agreement and murmured, Hear, hear.
So, Professor, sir, continued the sergeant, licking his chapped lips, got us another proof today?
Yeah, like the distribution of gravy in a pseudo-isotropic liquid?
Asked another man, holding up his mess tins, hopefully.
Gaseous homogeneity is the tricky bit, isn't it, General? Said another. In a crowded trench, naked flames, eh? How are you going to do that on a two-dimensional back of envelope, hopelessly rigid with regards Cartesian abscisses? That's what I would like to see. That's what keeps me awake on sentry duty.
Doesn't it us all? Murmured the rest of the men. Schwarzschild whispered to Sean. When the men get bored, they start postulating all over the place. I usually send them off on suicide missions just to get a bit of peace around here. At the end of the line, in both senses, they entered a transport compound, from which passenger vehicles arrived and departed with their doomed and deathly cargoes. Karl Schwarzschild turned to Sean thoughtfully and asked,
John, what are you really doing here?
Sean thought it was time to be honest.
I'm drawn to a watch.
Karl looked at Sean closely, then said,
Let me tell you something, John.
Before Galilei Galileo, the father of all we astronomers, gazed through his telescope, the cosmos was divided into two parts, below the moon and above the moon. This was because it was generally thought that the atmosphere reached as far as the moon. But Galileo told us that the sublunar world and the extralunar heavens were reflections of each other and cannot be separated. The physics was the same in both spheres, the point being that we were entitled to use the same language for both. It was thanks to Galileo that Newton and Leibniz saw the need for calculus, and it was Laplace who put down on paper a concise description of the cosmos for us all to see, and finally truly marvel at all creation. And so it is for me. Mathematics, physics, and astronomy, and their primary product, philosophy, are dialects of the one and same language. Their common grammar is derived from the rotation of the elements we see in the sky at night. I sometimes wonder, what if we had lived instead on a permanently clouded planet and had never seen the night sky? How different would our culture have been? In such a world, we would have been doomed to orbit forever around our own petty ideas, and arrogance would have felt justified in imposing a limited vision. And sometimes nationalism, prejudice, and dogma rise to cloud our horizons artificially in just such a way, and we lose our hard-earned common language. That is what this war is all about. Like Dante, sometimes we have to negotiate our way through a madhouse to see sanely once more. He took out his treasured packet of notes and tapped it with extended fingertips. And this we have compiled into a wonderful language with which to talk to the gods who built the cosmos. And you know what? I think they are just about to respond to us. Pity I won't be here to hear it. I know my time has run out. Honesty forbade Sean from using empty words. He instead hugged the master astronomer. I'm so glad to have met you. And me you, Sean. Remember me kindly. A staff sergeant came up, saluted Karl, then tapped a clipboard with a pencil.
Name? He barked at Sean.
Sean Saulpierre, private, replied Sean.
Private, the man scribbled. Class?
Economy? The staff sergeant stopped in midline.
No, this won't do. Won't do at all. Saulpierre? If you're French, then you're on the wrong front, me lad. You shouldn't be here. You're our right enemy, Germans and all that, but you're our wrong enemy. We have demarcation rules to comply with. The Union's not going to like this. Go and be killed where you belong. You'd better catch a long march back over to the west before you're missed.
He filled in a sickly yellow E-46B form entitled, Back to Front. Pointless movement for the sake of it, transfer permit. A form still used by the trucking industry in Europe today. He tore it off impatiently and pushed both it and Sean onto a long car about to leave. Karl jumped up onto the running board of the vehicle to say his farewell.
Would you do me a favour?
Drop by Berlin, would you, and give this to a certain Mr. Onestone? He handed Sean his bundle of papers wrapped up in sanguineous rations paper. You'll find him at Big Willie's Institute of Theatrical Physics. If he's performing, he'll be wearing his mad professor costume. You know, the fuzzy hair and big nose get-up. Kids love it. And oh, give him this as well. And say, thanks, he was right. It was very useful. He pulled up his sleeve, took off his wristwatch, and gave it to Sean. It was Sean's digital watch. The Sang Ray